For members of the Ethics Committee, I'm going to suggest that if there are no objections, that we'll consider the agenda approved as presented. Are there any objections? All right, thank you very much. Now we'll move on to approval of the minutes. Could I get a motion from a committee member for the approval of the minutes from the September 12, 2019 committee meeting? Moved by Mr. Rouse. Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Bolger. All those in favor? Any opposed? Any abstentions? I should also mention, like I did last time, that Mr. Rouse is filling in for Mr. Horner right now, as Mr. Horner's on his way to the meeting. So today, the committee will be considering the final proposed changes to the board's code of ethics. The committee has met 2 weeks ago and wanted the opportunity for jurisdictional input. All the proposed changes are designated to improve transparency, accountability, and fairness to all parties. And as you know, we've been talking about these reforms now since July. Our general counsel, Patty Lee, and ethics officer, Phil Staub, will review the latest proposed changes with us. Then the committee will be asked to take a vote on them and refer this to the board meeting later today. Ms. Lee.
Thank you. So the document that was posted on Diligent reflects the proposed changes to the ethics code that was presented on September 12th. Those changes were accepted as clean, and the red lines that you see in the version that was posted last night reflect changes based on discussions at the September 12th Ethics Committee meeting, as well as changes proposed by the state of Maryland after the September 12th meeting. So you just want me to just turn pages?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, so the first change is in Article 2D at the bottom of page 1, and the change is just to add that all board members shall keep confidential all matters involving WMATA and their respective jurisdiction. The next change is on the top of page 2, same section, Article 2B, and it is a deletion that board members are encouraged to advise the board of any such disclosure of confidential information to the leadership of their jurisdiction. That was a request of the state of Maryland. Next change is on the bottom of page 5, Article 5, B as in boy. The change is that instead of the Ethics Committee, the recommendation for a board member for declaration going from the Ethics Committee to the approval of the full board, it will now just go from the Ethics Officer to the approval of the full board. Again, that was a change proposed by the state of Maryland.
Mr. Goldman, yes.
There, as proposed by the state of Maryland, it would have been the Ethics Committee. I suggested then to the chair that a more efficient process would be to change Ethics Committee to Ethics Officer, since the Ethics Officer would probably make that recommendation anyway, and so we're essentially just making this a more streamlined process by taking out a middle step of the Ethics Committee and going directly to a recommendation from the Ethics Officer to approval by the board, and which I thought would satisfy the desire of the member for a more speedy resolution of the conflict.
Any comments on that from anyone else? Okay.
Page 6, Article 5C, just some minor cleanup changes there. I guess the significant change in Article 5B, and this is, I think, proposed by the state of Maryland, that now, in order to make a declaration, there has to be vote and approval. Okay, is page 10, Article 12C. the chair, first chair, or ethics committee make the request for a opinion regarding, a written opinion usually, regarding the application of the code to a specific question or situation regarding another board member on an issue that was before the committee. If the state of Maryland proposed to change that to just any board member may request an opinion regarding the application of the code to specific questions or situations regarding other board members.
Okay.
Just want to pick up a little what the general counsel just said in the frequently asked questions. I guess I had suggested that since we were changing the code to eliminate the distinction between an actual conflict and an apparent conflict, since now we just have the term conflict of interest, that we add some frequently asked questions, which will give some guidance to board members as to what are considered to be actual conflicts and what are considered to be apparent conflicts, because there's significance to that distinction because as I understand your presentation 2 weeks ago, in an actual conflict, there was no ability for making a declaration, participating by a declaration. The board member would actually have to recuse himself from any dealings with that particular perceived conflict. And so I think it's very important that we have some frequently asked questions that give guidance as to what general counsel and the ethics officer consider to be actual conflicts as opposed to apparent conflicts, so that board members can anticipate when they have such a situation, how to react and how to deal with it. So the question is, I think what you're saying is that the frequently asked questions, even in the most revised version, don't include any frequently asked questions that address the actual versus apparent conflict question. Is that correct?
It does.
Yes. Okay, which one?
There's three frequently asked questions about conflicts of interest. And the first one is an actual. The second one is one that could either be recusal or declaration. And the third one, we actually use the word apparent conflict. And again, we're trying to stay away from the distinction. I appreciate your question, but the new definition is a much lower bar. And so, therefore, again, we strongly advise board members to the extent you have questions about whether or not something is a conflict of interest, whether it's an actual or an apparent, that you seek guidance, because now there's no right line, that if it's an actual, you must recuse. If it's an apparent, you can either recuse or make a declaration. We would consider it on a fact-specific basis, but you know, as a general rule of thumb, most actual or real conflicts will likely require recusal. I can't think of a situation right now where an actual conflict would say, okay, go ahead and make a declaration. But again, it's very, you know, it's based on the facts and circumstances of each particular situation.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, but I still find it very unsatisfactory from the point of view of giving guidance to board members, both existing board members as well as future board members, as to what will be considered to be an actual conflict requiring recusal as opposed to just an apparent conflict. Now, this all sounds like, you know, mumbly-gook right now, but I think for an individual board member in a situation, you know, this can be a very serious matter. And I think some guidance in the frequently asked questions as to what kinds of facts and circumstances you are looking like, or even one or two examples of, you know, where one crosses the line into an actual conflict as opposed to an apparent conflict, you know, it is very important to give board members a kind of public guidance as to where they cross a line, rather than depend on just case-by-case, non-transparent conversations with the ethics officer. So, you know, that's sort of my position that I'd like to see. I don't know how my other colleagues feel about that.
So the frequently asked questions do set out hypothetical facts and circumstances on which the ethics officer and myself would make a decision one way or the other. Again, you know, I think it's unrealistic that we would be able to come up with a frequently asked question list to anticipate every single situation, but I think if you read the frequently asked questions as it's currently drafted, especially in the three on conflict of interest, I think you'll get a sense of what factors we'd be looking at to make that determination. Those factors are in the ethics relatives, if you have substantial interest or duty, those are all factors that we take into consideration, and those are all defined terms in the ethics code. So I'm not sure.
Right, but at this point, an apparent versus an actual conflict is not a defined term in the code.
I understand, but that is because we eliminate that distinction at the recommendation of some of the board members. That is why the prior code had that distinction. The recommendation was that we, in this next version, because that distinction was causing some board members, you know, confusion, that one broad lower bar definition of conflict of interest, and therefore, if a board member believes there's a situation where he or she cannot fairly and objectively make a decision, that's a flag right there. That's a conflict of interest. There's a potential for the conflict of interest, and therefore that's when you should come seek guidance from the ethics officer or myself. If you cannot fairly and objectively make a board decision, that's the guidance. And that language is in the code already.
Well, I guess I'm going to make a motion that what you just described as the distinction between an actual and an apparent conflict be reduced in writing to a frequently asked question that appears in this document, Appendix 2. I really think that that's the kind of thing that's needed going forward.
Phil.
I understand this is a big change from what the code used to say about actual and apparent conflicts, and there was a clear distinction between the two under the old code. What that would result in, for example, is the actual conflict was a substantial interest or duty in an interested party. So one of the examples that we present in the frequently asked questions addresses how that changes under this code. So formally, under the previous code, if you had let me double check the amount. If you had over a $15,000 interest in a party doing business with Metro, you would have a substantial interest or duty. That $15,000 does not change depending on the entity. So a massive entity, let's say like an Apple company, your $15,000 would result in an actual conflict and you would not be able to participate in the matter before the board. Under the new code, it is a conflict of interest that could be either handled by recusal or making a declaration. That distinction is now pointed out in the frequently asked questions. Now turn it around. So that's an example of what might be considered a minor interest in a party that before would have resulted in recusal, but now would offer the option of a declaration, but only with the ethics officer's recommendation and the full board approval. Now, a different example, under the previous code, if someone who is not a household member owned it like a brother, for instance, owned a company doing business with Metro, I think most people would view that as a very serious conflict of interest. But under the old code, that would not meet the definition of a substantial interest or duty in an interested party. So a board member could make a declaration and participate in the matter, notwithstanding that their brother owns the company that's being affected by the matter. Under the new code, that is just a conflict of interest, okay? And would, just like in my previous example, could result in either recusal or making a declaration, but again, only with the approval of the ethics officer and a vote of the full board. I would tell you in that example, it's very unlikely that the ethics officer is going to make a recommendation that a declaration is okay. So those are, I think that's the sort of guidance that board members need on how this now changes, and those are two of the three examples that are included in the frequently asked questions. I'd further point out that the frequently asked questions do not require board approval. They can be updated at any time. So if there is need for additional examples, we can add that after this action without further board involvement.
What you've just said is exactly what I'd like to see separately listed as a frequently asked question in this Appendix 2, and not have it hidden in other examples that deal with the definition of an interested party or what is the definition of a substantial interest. What you've stated, you know, is so valuable, and the problem is it's only being provided to you know, 1, 2, 3 board members and 1, 2, and 2 alternates at the present time. And you know, and this is the kind of thing which I think should be in our basic documents and not things that have to be, you know, found out by looking at a recording of a meeting of the Ethics Committee or having a one-on-one contact with you as the Ethics Officer. This should be transparent and upfront and not something that, you know, you have to dig out when you have a situation that confronts you. I just feel very strongly that to protect, you know, the integrity of our process and to really give board members, not just us, but board members on the full board and board members in the future, you know, the benefit of what is the difference between an actual and a apparent conflict, that some written guidance should be provided in these frequently asked questions.
Mr. McMillan and Mr. Morrison.
I think, Phil, if you had began your statement the way you ended it, we might have saved ourselves a lot of time. The frequently asked questions, what I just heard, are not something that are approved by board action. They are provided from the ethics team as information to board members at any time, an hour from now, next week, next month, next year. Any of us can submit a question, call it frequent, and have that adopted as part of Appendix 2 and made available to all board members. So, Mr. Goldman, I would encourage you to, well, I think they're already doing it probably as soon as we get out of this room. But if any of us have questions like that that might be of interest to other board members, then we should submit them to council and we'll get them added to Appendix 2.
Well, I think we can shortcut this by making a formal request that council consider providing me some explanation and some guidance on what they will consider in future to be an apparent conflict and what they will consider to be an actual conflict in the dealings of a board member, such as myself, who has a potential conflict. So if you can address that.
We're happy to do so.
Thank you.
Mr. Dorsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would remind us that we do have an annual ethics training that's in full public transparent view. So that's an opportunity to get into the specific examples that may be applicable to a particular board member. So I don't want us to lose sight of that. I will say that for this board member, I think one of the benefits of limiting the frequently asked questions to include the scenarios that are most common, even if the scenarios to include the substantial areas of finding that are most common, even if the scenarios are not fully reflective and comprehensive of everything. One of the benefits of that is that it invites all of us board members to be in the mindset of, if there is a question, ask. I would be a little concerned with trying to make those FAQs so comprehensive that we reorient our thinking to say, well, I don't see my situation in there, I'm therefore okay. I think the norm that you're trying to set is, if you're fuzzy at all, the best thing to do is to surface it as a question to the ethics officer, and I think that's the best thing for the authority, is that we get out of this business of having board members self-select and decide what is and what is not a conflict, and to surface anything that is meaningfully ambiguous and have it go through a full review of the committee. So I think where you are makes a lot of sense to me.
Mr. Bolger, I saw your hand.
Professional question. So we go to American Public Transportation Association Legislative Committee meeting or Legislative Conference, and they have a reception, which they do usually in the cafeteria of the Rayburn Building where the soda machines are, so it's very, very proper. But you find out when you walk into the cafeteria that the reception's sponsored by fill-in-the-blank number of transit companies, which doesn't show up in the program. What do we do? Walk out?
There is a subscribe to the reception.
In other words, they solicit corporate sponsorship for their reception.
Right. But if it's so, under Appendix 1, which is the exceptions to accepting gifts, there is an exception for widely
attended, right.
Right, gatherings, and if it's the type of gathering that is widely attended, it's not by invitation only.
Okay.
And, the food and beverages are all for there, everybody else participates, and it's not excessive, then you should be able to.
Okay.
Yeah, the frequently asked questions from Mac addresses that very situation.
And for some additional background for folks, given the last case that we were dealing with, I think it became pretty clear to members of the Ethics Committee at that time that this whole actual versus apparent issue maybe caused some confusion, and that's why it was one of the recommendations in the letter. So we sort of get rid of that confusion or ambiguity there, and as Christian said, if you have any reason at all, or it was our thinking anyway, that if there was any reason at all that you think there was a financial or any other kind of conflict, that you side on being overly cautious and going to the ethics officer, whatever, you know, whether it's a dollar or, you know, $10,000 or you know, whatever the situation is. So that was some of the thinking and why the Ethics Committee made, or the members who signed the letter, put it into, the letter there for recommendation, for consideration of some of the changes. So there wasn't that distinction that if you had any question at all, as Christian said, you would just immediately go to the ethics officer and ask he or she to you know, make it, give you an opinion. All right. Do we have any other final comments, changes? Okay. So with that, is there a motion to move the proposed changes?
So moved.
Just a regular motion. Okay, that we accept the changes that are outlined and have been gone over here by the General Counsel and the Ethics Officer. We have a motion by Mr. Bolger. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Goldman. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Thank you very much. If there's no other business, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you.